You're listening to Decolonize Social Work, a conversation about social work, oppression, and liberation. I'm your co-host, Drew.
And I'm your co-host, Ondine. All right, welcome to part two. We've been having a fantastic conversation with our friend CT, who has over 20 years experience in the child welfare system. We hope that you've enjoyed the conversation up to this point. So here in part two, we're going to cover some new stuff. And again, just like with the first part of this episode, if you have the ability to use headphones to listen, we recommend it just because we know the sound quality for this episode isn't quite what we're used to bringing to you all. Thanks for your patience. And yeah, enjoy.
So when I first started working, we did not see a lot of Latino-Hispanic families. I think just the demographic of the city at the time didn't really reflect that. And I remember the first time we had a case where there was a Hispanic dad and the mom was white. And I mean, you would have thought, like, oh my gosh, oh my God, what do we do? Like, where do we put this kid? And I'm just like, what's the situation? Mm-hmm. You know, can we figure that part out first? Now, what I do remember is that the dad actually got custody of the kid.
Interesting.
And so, for men who find themselves, or anyone who identifies as male, who find themselves in this system, wins for men in child welfare are few and far between. Even if, like, you are hands down the safest parent, or the other parent has got so many other issues that are interrupting their ability to safely parent. Mm-hmm. And I say that language very specifically. I didn't say because they're a bad parent.
Right.
Because they have a host of other things that they're experiencing. Trauma, violence, substance abuse, untreated mental health issues, mm-hmm. poverty, none of which people choose.
Right.
And so I was so shocked when he got custody. And I was like, does this work? Is this when this works? Is this what this looks like when it sort of works? But the situation still, like, they just didn't know how to do it. Like, you would have thought he was a unicorn.
I mean, that just fits in again to this colonizer framework.
Yes.
There are certain roles for men and mm-hmm. certain roles for women, mm-hmm. and that white women are the pinnacle of sort of good motherhood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was also thinking, too, the way you were saying that these cases rarely favor men and how that is still even blaming women in that regard for not being the parent that they're mm-hmm. supposed to be. So, mm-hmm. because obviously we can't expect this guy to take over the responsibilities of
right.
this. And I was also just thinking, too, like, God forbid if you're not in a hetero couple in that, if you're just two men, like, what do you, you're just...
Yeah, what happens to queer people who
yeah.
are caught up in this system?
When I was, again, early in my career, I had this one client who was a lesbian, and I realized that because she actually told me, mm-hmm. and, like, the way she told me, you all, there was so much fear.
Mm-hmm.
She was, she came to my office to tell me that, and I just remember going, okay. Like,
she was expecting.
It seemed like you were coming here to tell me something bad, and so, like, I haven't heard anything bad. And like, I distinctly remember, like, her face changed.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so shocked. She was like, but I'm gay. And I was like, okay.
Mm-hmm. However, I'm sure not everybody in your position would have reacted like that.
No. And really, her situation was, like, she had a feisty teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my God, somebody probably should have removed my ass when I was a teenager, too.
Yeah, me too.
Like, who wouldn't? Like, you lose your mind when you're a teenager. No one should expect, like, teenagers to be sane. That's not how that goes.
Mm-mm.
But she was so terrified that somehow I would write that in her case plan. Or, like, I would write that in her record. And I was like, that's not, oh, like, no, I'm not putting that. That doesn't need to be put anywhere because that's not a, that's not a problem. Is it a problem for you? It's not a problem.
If somebody else might have coded that as what did you say earlier? Exposing.
Oh, I can see. Exposure to deviant sexual behavior
mm-hmm.
or sexual exploitation. But I would be so happy when I would see, there were a couple times where I did family team meetings and it was like finalizing an adoption and it was a same-sex adoption. And I was like, I'm so happy for you.
Yeah.
Because they were happy. These kids were just thriving. And I'm like, listen, I don't care who you live with. As long as they can provide your basic needs, like you're not being really abused. Like, You're not being sexually assaulted. Somebody's not beating the shit out of you every night.
Right, right.
They're not starving you on purpose.
Right.
You know, they're not locking you outside of the house as punishment. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, that's what abuse really, really is. Somebody being poor, somebody having a substance abuse issue, to me, is not even abusive. Because, that, listen, we all know that there are substance abusing rich white folks.
Oh, my goodness.
Who have a host of kids. That's and ain't
right.
Nobody coming to get their kids.
That's right.
Nobody's coming to get their kids.
Also, just because you smoke weed or drink alcohol doesn't mean that you're doing it when your kids are around.
Right.
While you're supposed to be watching your
right.
kids.
Right. Like, workers really had, a lot of workers really thought that, like, kids were just living, like, in drug dens. You know, and that, like, there's just, like, high people laying all over the floors and, you know, people, just random people coming in and out.
Not that, like, kids are even fed mm-hmm. and bathed and are in bed mm-hmm. and their parents are smoking a joint, relaxing.
I remember a case that I did a family team meeting on, and mom or parent, Yale's mom, tested positive for weed. Kid was at grandma's house for like the whole weekend. And I'm just doing this thing like, why are we even here?
Right.
Why the shit are we even here?
Right.
And that just kept going on and on and on and on and on, as if. Like, she's smoking a crack pipe, sitting in, like, holding the baby in one hand and smoking a crack pipe in the other hand.
Blowing the smoke in her face.
Yes! The kid wasn't even there! And then the relative was like, I don't, like, can't you go, like, she needs to go home. Can't you go home? And so there's also the aspect of, like, relative placement.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, in most cases, it is better, like, if you're gonna have to remove a kid, at least put them with somebody that they know.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And I saw so many cases where kids would get removed from relatives because relatives allowed access to the kid for the parent. Like, somebody went to the store and left biological mom and the kid in the house at the same time. And then it becomes a failure to protect by the relative. And then the relative's like, well, we can't, the system is like, we can't trust you to protect these kids because you left this child unsupervised with the parent that they're not supposed to be unsupervised.
So now this child has to go to be with strangers.
Yes.
Yep. God knows who they may be. And there are some wonderful foster parents. Mm-hmm.
But there are some trash-ass foster parents. At one point in my life, I reviewed all of the reports that came in on foster parents across the state. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, how are these people foster parents?
Yeah.
Like, The home that you removed them from was nowhere near as bad as this home. I mean, I've seen some shit.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some shit happen in some foster homes. And I'm just like, you, ma'am, should be arrested.
Mm.
You should be arrested.
Mm.
I mean, I know of kids who've been assaulted in multiple ways in foster homes. And they don't close those homes.
It really makes me wonder, because I know that the foster system, at least in theory, is supposed to have a lot of stages and, like, mm-hmm. protections and stuff. And if it's like, who is this protecting in that if you can still get through all those checks and balances, mm-hmm. I suppose, and then you're still providing less care for them.
Using kids.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and like the home you removed them from.
Mm-hmm. It is, this system doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't sound like it. And I was, when we were talking a little bit about like removing kids mm-hmm. and putting them in different placements and who gets removed, mm-hmm. I was reflecting back again about like the experience to like indigenous folks getting mm-hmm. their children taken away from mm-hmm. them. And back to this Teen Vogue article, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. This is about South Dakota in particular, but in South Dakota, a Native child is 11 times more likely to be placed in foster care than a white child.
Ooh.
Natives comprise less than 9% of the state's population, excuse me, but 52% of the kids in South Dakota foster care are indigenous. And, you know, this goes
That's
on.
That's criminal.
Isn't it, though?
That is 1,000% criminal.
Right, and there's, you know, there are totally, like, laws on the books that Native kids are going to be placed into foster care families that are of Native people.
Indian Child Welfare Act is supposed to do that.
But apparently that's not the case.
Yeah, laws are only meaningful if they're followed and enforced.
Well, but here's the other catch. Who gets to be a foster parent? And, like, what does your record have to look like?
Mm-hmm.
So you could have a misdemeanor drug possession charge from 20 years ago. Can't be a foster parent. And so,
and when we know who gets charged,
there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if we have to spell that out for the listener.
Oh, Lord, I hope not. But it's not white folks.
It's not white
people. There you go. It's not white people. There you go. Yeah. And so that also contributes probably to these high rates.
Yeah.
And why these kids are not going into homes that will honor and celebrate and nurture their culture. Right. Because the homes are, it's the same culture home.
This is a pretty clear example of institutionalized oppression and institutionalized racism, where it's like, we can write this neutral sounding law that says, yeah, we'll try to relocate these kids into families that have their same culture or background or whatever, accepting for the fact that, like, we know that these are also families that we have targeted with over-policing. Mm-hmm. We know they're more likely to maybe have had a substance abuse charge or something like that. So while we say in intent that we're going to try to reunite them with families from their own culture, own region, the impact is like, we really don't. And we're actually not trying to fix that impact either, because, again, this is a mechanism we use to blame those cultures for failing.
And to what extent is family reunification and family preservation an actual goal of child welfare?
Well, it's a goal on paper.
I've read that, but I'm asking you.
And what's funny is it is literally the goal until a judge says it's not.
Right. So in your experience, how true is that? How committed are social workers in particular to that?
Well, I will say that it often depends on the age of the kid. So the younger a kid, I've seen situations where, you know, someone has a baby. Baby comes into care for whatever reason. And when workers are trying to figure out where to place this child, if it's not going to be with a relative or whatever, it's going to foster care. Is this an adopted home? They'll ask that. And they'll think, like, they'll place babies in adoptive homes that are fostered to adopt. Mm-hmm. And to me,
they're already, like, tracking this kid to probably not go back home to their birth parents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, like, there are situations where, you know, if a child is born addicted to meth, the likelihood that baby is going to go back home is very small. Now, I have seen it happen. It doesn't happen that frequently. But the other catch is that there are federal laws that play that only give you a small amount of time. Let's say you do have a substance abuse issue. You only have a small amount of time to be able to get treatment. Well, first of all, you got to get in treatment.
Mm-hmm.
You got to complete treatment. You've got to maintain sobriety. You've got to prove that you can hold down a job and that you can have secure housing, independent housing, so you could move back in with your mom.
Right.
Who's a great support system.
Has all kinds of wealth that support you.
Yeah, can't move in with her. Right. Even if her record is squeaky clean, can't move in with her. You have to have your own housing. And so if we're really honest about how long it takes someone to address a pretty significant substance abuse issue, you look at anywhere between 24 and 36 months.
Yeah.
You have 24 months from the time that child is removed from your custody to get that child back. 24 months goes by quick.
Absolutely.
I think it's 24. Maybe it's 20. I think it's 24 though. And so I'm addicted to meth. I'm addicted to pills.
Mm-hmm.
How easy is it to get into treatment? There's a wait list for treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you think I'm going to be doing while I'm waiting for treatment? Well, make sure you go to, you know, all these NA meetings. I ain't going to damn NA meetings. I'm not going to. I need to go to treatment. That's not treatment.
Right.
And so. It is the worst system that can show up on a family's doorstep. It just is the absolute worst. It doesn't have to be, though.
So that I'm glad that's a good segue, because I think we've probably made a pretty good case, right? The child welfare system in the United States is flawed. Not that folks didn't know that. Beyond just flawed, it is predicated on holding up a system of white supremacy.
Absolutely.
And it was designed by colonizers.
Absolutely.
And by design, it was also intent to separate communities, mm-hmm. separate people from their communities mm-hmm. who didn't fit the norms of white supremacy.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a part of me that's like, Should we just burn it down? Like, what does a social worker do?
I've always been of the opinion, and will always be of the opinion, that the vast majority of cases that are open didn't have to be opened in the first place. Mm-hmm. Because there, people have seen signs of things the entire time before it gets to the cabinet.
Yeah.
And so if we spent more money on prevention and, like, job trainings and making sure people actually get a living wage and that there's affordable housing, and that if someone is struggling with substance abuse issues, that access to treatment is super easy.
That's right.
Or that, you know, we don't penalize people for getting jobs and they make 25 cents too much. And so now they don't qualify for
stamps.
They can't get food stamps. They can't get child care.
That's right.
If we stop doing that, then only the people, only the families that literally are likely to kill their kids from something, those would be the only people in the system.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be the only ones. And maybe, you know, in some cases, maybe you might be able to do something with those families. But child welfare is a business.
So this is where capitalism steps in.
Child welfare is a business because private child care facilities depend on a system to constantly feed those, you gotta keep those beds full. Mm. And so there's money to be made in child welfare.
Mm.
Like, people don't want to talk about that, but private child care facilities are not nonprofits.
Mm.
Those are businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to take the highest level kid. And so if we get a bunch of level 5 kids, the cabinet is paying the most money for those kids. And so we have a vested interest in upholding this whole system because it's how I pay my bills.
So what I'm hearing is that for social workers in particular, really working for raising a living wage, working towards getting
that's social work.
That's the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're sitting in your social work class, like, I want to help people.
Mm-hmm.
I love kids.
Mm-hmm.
If you're
please get out. Please get out. Please get out.
This is part of the social work where I didn't get a lot of education, and I don't think any of us did, about, like, community organizing,
right,
and responding and,
mm-hmm,
really building solutions within communities,
mm-hmm,
that center families,
mm-hmm,
and kind of provide that model of transformative justice, not,
yeah,
punitive justice.
Right.
And I mentioned this to you all before, but, like, I've been reading this book called The Revolution Starts at Home, and it's,
mm-hmm,
a lot of examples of community-based responses,
mm-hmm,
to people who are survivors,
mm-hmm,
of domestic violence, and basically coming up with a model that addresses this and,
mm-hmm,
attempts to resolve it without involving the state,
mm-hmm,
or the police.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's an opportunity for social workers to really kind of get galvanized and begin something similar to that,
mm-hmm,
that would, like you said earlier, would become more preventative and not so reactive, so that nobody even has to get called to CPS in the first place.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't want anybody to have to get called into that kind of a system, because I know once you in it, you might not survive it. Your kid might not survive it. I mean, it is the worst thing. But there's so much other stuff that can be done before it gets to that point.
Like the lady you were talking about with the kids in the bed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So many options.
So
one of which was to leave her alone.
That's right. That was,
yeah,
the first option.
So what advice, or what would you tell social workers who are currently working within child welfare?
My gut tells them to get out.
I thought that might be what you would say.
But I think.
But you know, if they get out, then also who's left?
Well, I mean, it's a pipeline. Like, they will, you know. For every worker that drops out, there's 5 that'll come right in.
Yeah.
And what I would tell workers who are in this now is never forget that these are actual human beings who have not chosen. Nobody has chosen the path that has gotten them into that spot.
Mm-hmm.
And it is because systems have failed.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I remember when I was at one point in my career doing parenting classes, my goal was to teach people, this is what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they're looking for. And we always worked about protective capacity. And if people really look more at strengthening a person's protective capacity, you're really talking about, like, support systems, access to resources, coping mechanisms, all of those kinds of, like, basic sort of things.
Yeah.
if we did more work around that in a more preventive way, and workers can do that. Like, there's a way for workers to do that. And let me say this very clearly. I've had the honor of working with some phenomenal workers and some phenomenal supervisors who were really, like, family-centered first as opposed to process and policy-centered. And I have the utmost respect for those folks because, to me, they were doing the work the way that it needed to be done, not the way the work was written in a policy manual.
No, they weren't worshiping the written word.
They were not. They were not. And there were lots of situations where I'm like, so you're not going to remove? And they're like, no. We're going to put family preservation in. We're going to put tap services in. We're going to put X, Y, and Z services in because we want to keep this family together.
Right.
Because nobody's going to win if we rip them apart. And so nobody wins when we rip families apart.
I wonder how hard it was for those folks to work in that machine, but to maintain that strong sense of, like, justice for the families they were working with.
I mean, I think the two folks that I'm thinking about, I worked with them probably for about 5 years, and then they left. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh my gosh, y'all to leave. And, like, I literally mourned the fact that they weren't going to be there because I felt like they were folks who, like, they were the last line of defense for these families.
Yeah.
And they worked with integrity, they worked with humility, they worked transparently. They did not put things on people's case plans just for shits and giggles. Mm-hmm. That is not what they did. And they were so supportive of family. And it just the way that they dealt with them was so completely different. And I was like, you all are doing this work the way that it's supposed to do. Like, people are supposed to do it. But I also understand for workers, they're overworked. Mm-hmm. They are struggling with secondary trauma that nobody really talks to them about.
I was wondering if that would come up.
Listen, the most traumatic thing that I have ever been a part of is removals. And nobody can prepare you for all of the flood of emotions in a removal. Mm. You've got a parent who is freaking out, rightfully so. Keep in mind, everybody is assessing how you're freaking out.
Of course.
And they use it against you later.
And they use it against
you later. You're saying your feelings, yeah. Your emotions.
Well, like, mom cuts the work out. Well, when you just took a kid, what you expect her to do? Shake your damn hand? You're lucky she didn't swing on me. Mm-hmm. You're real lucky she didn't swing on me because that maternal instinct, like, everything I know, everything in some of these moms and dads too, and any kind of caregiver. Like, you're coming to get my kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got to fight. Like, this is fight or flight for real. But, like, any sort of negative interaction during a removal, and people are like, well, you know.
Of course.
They were they were just so aggressive during the removal. And I'm just like, are y'all shitting me right now? Like, y'all would get aggressive if I took that Twinkie away from you, let alone when you get into it.
And, you know, you earlier mentioned during removals, like, sort of SWAT teams, right, being involved.
Worst one I've ever been a part of, and literally the SWAT team was there. And I shudder to think, like, how traumatized those kids were and how traumatized those parents were, because it was literally like a battering ram that they used to bust down the door. And then you just hear all of this, police, and all of it, like, just like it is on television.
Yeah.
Imagine being 3 years old in the back of the room. And, like, they literally bust down the
door. You're not going to be okay after that.
You can't be.
There's no way.
You cannot be okay. And then they just pick you up and hand you to two random-ass people that you've never met.
Mm-hmm.
And then what do you do?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
What do you do? And then you take them. So somebody kicked down my parents' door. My parents are freaking out. The police are here. Everybody's yelling. It's violent.
Mm-hmm.
You hand me off to some this strange person, and then they drop me off to somebody else's strange house where nothing smells the same, nothing feels the same, the food ain't the same, the bed don't feel the same.
Yeah.
Like, they use different, like, everything is different. And you expect kids to be okay, and they're never going to be okay. You can't be okay from that. It is impossible. It is impossible.
And you've been out of this work for a long time, mm-hmm. and you still remember. I did talk about that secondary trauma
yesterday.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember going to the substation. I remember where we had to sit in the car. I remember them just like literally just handing these kids us like it was a sack of groceries. And it was so dark because it happened at night. It was so dark. And so I'm thinking like, well, great, now these kids are terrified of nighttime. And because that's what they will remember when it gets dark, is somebody else gonna come and get me. And so, yeah, I promise you I still carry a lot of secondary trauma.
I don't see how a social worker in their role, I don't see how that couldn't follow you home and haunt you unless you're dead inside.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. It led to insomnia. I remember the worst experience I had with insomnia. Like, I didn't sleep for 3 days. 3 whole days. Like, I would go to bed and I would just lay there. And just, like, you're tossing and turning and you can't sleep. I literally had to call in sick, and I slept for 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And that didn't even feel like enough. I would buy a fifth of vodka on probably Mondays. I'd buy another one on Wednesday, because that would be gone. And then I'd buy another one on Friday. And I did that probably for a good, I know probably a good 6-7 months. Wow. And was just like, this is insane. Mm-hmm. This is insane. And I know there are high rates of anxiety, depression, mental health issues with workers, substance abuse issues with workers, mm-hmm. because everybody's trying to self-medicate because you're doing the worst shit on a daily basis. Every single day, you are in a system that destroys people's lives, and you're complicit in it, and you know you're complicit in it. And then you got to go home and, like, sit with
them. Go see your own kids.
Go see your own kids.
So for young folks who are going into the social work profession, who are getting recruited to come work for child welfare, don't do it.
But if you are going to do it, you really have to understand what it is that you're getting into. You have to have a plan for how you're going to debrief all of this trauma that you are going to carry. You cannot go into this work thinking, I'm doing it because I love kids and I just want to save people. You are going to be the first ones that are going to fuck something all the way up. Mm-hmm. And you won't last. You won't last 6 months if you go into it thinking that. When I taught a class, it was an intro to child welfare class. On the first days, I would say, my goal is to weed you all out. Because not all of y'all need to be in this work, and not all of y'all will make it. Mm-hmm. And so I would be really, really honest about this is what it is like. I know this book is on the syllabus, but don't get that book. Because that book is a lie. Mm-hmm. Because that book makes it seem hopeful. And it's not. It can't be. Like, child welfare cannot be hopeful. It's not set up that way. It is just not set up that way. But I mean, young folks do it, but I think they target a very specific group of folks who are just so, like, I got student loans to pay for. Mm-hmm. I need a job. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to take this job, and holy shit, oh my God, now I'm doing this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I've just seen, like, the life be drained out of people doing this kind of work. It's hard. It changes how you are. It really, really does. And I think for me, it made me a much better fighter for other people. And it made me less fearful about speaking truth to power.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I had to do that. And so I pissed off half of this town. I pissed off, shit, I got kicked out as a CPS down there. But that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. What y'all are going to hear is like, you ain't shit. This is unfair. Y'all don't like black people. Like, you're going to hear all of that. And I have to do that way because I can't continue to be so complicit in this. Like, I cannot do this.
I mean, I would go so far as to say social workers have a responsibility.
We have an obligation. Yeah. Child welfare violates damn near every NAACP code of ethics out there.
I was just thinking that when you said that people were like, oh, I want to save children. I was like, that's hella paternalism right there. Like, who do you think you are?
I'm the worker. I'm the state. I'm the government. And so, yes, I get to come in and save these poor little black and brown kids, and occasionally some white ones, mm-hmm. but mostly black and brown ones. Because, like, I can do that.
From these benighted parents that don't know any better.
These trash, these awful, awful people who shouldn't be having kids anyway.
So the white colonizer machine continues churning mm-hmm. on.
You know, know, and I thought about this too, because you were talking about the stuff that happened in the 19th century with the removal of indigenous school kids, and like how that was really an operation of the state, right, to like kill the Indian, save the man, and it really reminds me of like what is actually literally going on today at the border of the United States with Mexico, where they are separating children from their families as a policy to deter people from trying to come into this country to seek asylum. And the person, yeah, the person who's at the head of this, the official at the Department of Health and Human Services, his name is Jonathan White.
Yeah, we should always say their names. Always name them.
He is the head of this.
Remover-in-chief.
Yeah, the remover-in-chief. Yeah. And when it came to answering some questions about the plan to reunify these families that have been separated by the state, he actually says, this is only the second scariest part of this, he actually says that by removing the children from these quote-unquote sponsor homes would be too traumatizing and destabilizing for them and shouldn't do it.
So basically it's too traumatizing to reunite these kids
with their families parents that they just came through. And here's the first most scary thing about that, is this guy, Jonathan White, is a social worker.
Jonathan White? You couldn't make that up.
I mean,
he's a social worker.
He's a social worker. That's, he actually cited his background as a social worker for his expertise in making this decision to not try to reunify the children because it would be too traumatizing.
Sir, you are absolutely 1,000% incorrect in every possible way.
Yeah. Yeah.
In every possible way. I have never, ever, ever seen a kid not be happy to go home.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Kids who do experience, like, for real abuse, always love their parents.
Yeah.
Like, that love that a kid has for their parent, like, very rarely ever dies. They just want the shit to stop. But they all want to go home. They all want to go home. And so, whoever this dude is, like, sir, you, that is, shame on you for that.
Yeah.
Because that is absolute trash.
I think we should take away his social work credentials.
So don't call yourself a social worker.
Yes, shame on him for even invoking our profession and
right?
being involved in that. Like, we are opposed to that. We should be. It is our very fundamental mission to be opposed to that.
Well, you know, that's a load of shit. And the whole thing with snatching kids from people who all they're trying to do is find a better life. Like, that's what we're doing here?
Yeah.
Like, I want not to be shot down in the street due to gang violence.
That's right.
Like, I want to be able to raise my kids in a place that it's less likely that it's like somebody in the middle of the night just going to come and get them and they're going to be human trafficked all over the world. Like, come on. Yeah. It is a disgusting, I mean, well, that's what people voted for. That's what y'all voted for. Some of y'all voted for.
You know, all those social workers who are listening right now, like, he's one of us, right?
Yeah.
So all of you all are like, oh, I can't believe that. I would never do that. Or I don't think that. Or social work isn't that. It is, though.
It always has been.
One of your classmates, one of your coworkers is that dude.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Shit, some of y'all that dude.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to be calling that out.
Yeah.
Every time we see
it. Every single time. Every single time. Because that sort of, I can't, like, I to think about what is going on with those kids and their families and the fact that this nation has lost thousands of people. How you lose thousands of kids? How you just lose them?
Yeah.
And so we're going to reunite kids and family, but we don't know where, like, we didn't bother to figure out.
I read a story recently about one of these kids getting turned over to a parent. It was the wrong kid, wrong parent.
Well, they brown, like, you brown, they brown, like, work it out. Figure it out. it is the most, I feel like child welfare is a really unnecessary system. Yeah. We don't have to have it. We don't have to have it,
but this nation, which is founded on colonizing people and uplifting structures of white supremacy, needs it to survive.
Absolutely, that's right. I think that's important, too. Like, yeah. Like you said, people make money off of it, so it's, you know, capital, there's an interest, a capitalist interest in this system existing, and then also to control and subjugate people, this system has to exist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we struggled to come up with any, we looked a little bit about whether or not there were examples of people doing it differently. I would love if anyone...
I don't know how you do this.
I don't know. Short of just creating some community-based responses that happen outside of the state.
Mm-hmm. But I do think, like, if you look at communities outside of the United States who have not been infected with Western culture, there's some systems that don't have child welfare systems. Like, they don't have them. You know why? Because they deal with everything within the community. Mm-hmm. And so... the process of a family team meeting was really based on like family group conferencing, which is an indigenous practice. There's a problem, somebody has an issue, cool. We all gonna come together to figure out how we do whatever we need to do for this family, for these kids, for whatever this situation is. We're handling this as a community because it is a community issue. And like what would it look like if we could get to that? If that was the system.
Yeah, I would also love to hear from any listeners. If that is the way you're doing your work, mm-hmm. I want to know about it.
Yeah.
I think looking out, as people are going to try to get people who we see as not doing parenting right, like what has happened to us, that's the initial reaction and not to like, how can I help with this? You know, it reminds me of that in 2014, there was a woman, Deborah Harrell in North Carolina, where she had to go work a shift, a job at McDonald's, and thought, this is not a place for a kid to have to spend 8 hours. Gave her child the cell phone and went to go play at a public park in the middle of the day, and it was fine. And after being there for 2 days, another parent saw this kid there by themselves. And when the kid told the parent, like, oh, my mom's at work, that parent, who's probably white, the first reaction was to call CPS. Mm-hmm. CPS went, fucking arrested Deborah Harrell. And it's just like, what was wrong with that person? And they're just like, this is somebody who needs some help. And where was the social worker that got charged with that? It was like, we need to actually get this person connected with some child care services.
Easy fix.
And this is also another symptom of that capitalism, where it's like, McDonald's ain't paying for child care services the workers. Like, where is the complicity in that? Like, they are actually participating in family violence.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Let's say that again. McDonald's is participating in family violence. We're going to get in trouble.
Yeah, sorry. We don't pay money.
Guess McDonald's going to be a sponsor.
These 2 for 2s are going to be forbidden.
Well, I feel like we've read everybody for film.
Yeah, we have. And I do want to say, you know, to workers that are out there who are trying their best to do this in the best way possible, like, just do not forget that these are human beings and that our decisions that we think are going to be best for a family aren't always the right decisions. And those decisions that we do make have ripple effects for generations. Mm-hmm. And you cannot take that responsibility lightly. I know, like, the training will sort of gloss over those kinds of things. But, like, don't forget, don't ever lose sight of people's humanity. That these are human beings who've had experiences, who are trying to navigate systems that are set up for failure for them. Have a little bit of empathy in your work. Like, it's not hard, but I guess it is. It wasn't hard for me once I realized really what was happening. But that's something that we don't teach, and they don't really talk about that when they're training workers. Mm-hmm. It is, here's the policy. If it's a policy violation, this is what you do. You got to protect kids. Mm-hmm. Well, protecting kids does not always equal snatching them from the only family that they've ever known. Very rarely does that. Like, that's not a thing. That's punitive. Mm-hmm. And so call it what it is. Call it the child welfare, the child punitive system. It's still CPS. Mm-hmm. But just like that, name what it is. Mm-hmm. Just name what it is. But don't, this isn't about protection. It's about punishment.
You've been listening to Decolonize Social Work, a podcast about social work, oppression, and liberation. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud at Decolonize SW, and on Instagram at Decolonize Social Work.